Good evening. I'm Dr. Elliot Malamut. I'm going to give a very brief introduction before turning to our speaker. I'm actually going to take the introduction right out of his book, which is called The Holy Fire. Our topic for this evening is Rabbi Kolonimus Kalman Shapira. He was one of the luminous figures of 20th century Hasidism in Poland, a world that is no more. He was known as the Piazzetna Rebbe. He was a multifaceted personality who served as a Hasidic master to an intellectual elite, as well as to the desperately poor common folk of interbellum Poland. He was famed as a pedagogue, an educational theorist, and a founder of a yeshiva, and he was also sought after for medical advice and referrals. In the Warsaw Ghetto, as Polish Jewry went through its death agony, Rabbi Shapira continued to teach, to encourage, to give material and spiritual support, and finally show how it is possible to maintain faith in the midst of profound darkness and despair. His last book, which he referred to as Torah Insights from the Year of Wrath, 5700 to 5702, was among the manuscripts that he buried in 1943. It was eventually published in Israel under the title Eish Kodesh, Fire of Holiness. It was obviously composed during a time of utter personal crisis and total communal devastation after he had already lost most of his family. And it is the last work of Hasidism that was written in Poland. To talk about the Eish Kodesh with me, I'm delighted to have with us Rabbi Dr. Nechemia Polin, who's a leading expert in Hasidism and Jewish thought and a widely published author. His books include The Holy Fire, which is the teachings of Rav Kolonimus Kalman Shapira, as well as The Rebbe's Daughter, which is based on his research as a National Endowment for the Humanities Fellow and a recipient of the National Book Award, Jewish Book Award, and also Filling Words with Light, Hasidic and Mystical Reflections on Jewish Prayer, which he wrote with Lawrence Kushner. His doctorate is from Boston University, where he studied with and served as a teaching fellow for Elie Wiesel. And prior to his career in academia, he served as 23 years as a congregational rabbi. Please welcome Nechemia Polin. So I want to begin with the period before the Shoah, just briefly so you can give a context for who we're talking about tonight. So if you can briefly sketch what the world of Poland was prior to the war that Rav Shapira was working and teaching in, and it seems from some of his pre-war work that he was deeply concerned about what he saw as the declining spiritual condition of Polish Jewry, including somewhat widespread defection from Judaism. What was his plan to revitalize the Hasidic world? This is prior to the Holocaust.
Well, thank you very much. Right into the mic. Can you hear me? Is this okay? No?
Go right into the mic.
Can we boost the sound a little bit? Okay. So, yes, we tend, first of all, thank you very much, Dr. Malamut. We tend to have perhaps an overly...
You're going to have to stick the mic over into the mic.
Okay.
Sure. Yeah, that's right.
We tend to have a romanticized view of the condition of the Jewish community in Eastern Europe. You know, everyone was living in a pious, isolated shtetl, and it was only later that the waves of assimilation came. This is really not the case. Well before the Holocaust, the Jewish community as a whole, and certainly the Hasidic community, was facing one crisis after another. Hasidism began in the backwaters, indeed in the shtetls, of the small towns of Eastern Europe. And by the late 1800s, and certainly during and after World War I, there was a large movement to the major cities, Warsaw, Krakow, Lodz, Vienna, Budapest, and other places as well. And when the isolated Hasidic community entered the large cities, they were accosted by different experiences, encounters with the modern world that they hadn't seen before, and ideological movements. The world of science, the world of Western culture, political movements. There was a very, very vibrant politics at the time. Zionism, number one. There was Bundism as well. There was socialism. There was communism. And everybody had the answer for the Jewish community, for their problems, and for the world as a whole. Many Jews, many Jews, including the Hasidim, were caught up in this fervor. So there were many Hasidic households where there were large defections, especially on the part of the youth, going away from the Hasidic lifestyle and entering some version of the modern world. Rabbi Shapira was well aware of this, and I don't know that he had a complete solution, but his feeling was that by the 20th century, Hasidism had become to some degree routinized. That is to say, the Hasidic lineages trace back to the early 1800s. In another context, I was talking earlier about Chabad and Karlin Stollen and Kozhenitz and many other lineages. And by the 20th century, it was common for young men and women to feel that to be a Hasid meant to be part of a Hasidic community. If you dressed in a certain way, if you spoke in a certain way, if you had certain customs, certain traditions, even certain Hasidic melodies, then you were a Hasid. And that was not enough to resist this attraction of the modern world. The Piasetzna Rebbe, Rabbi Shapiro, said, we really need to go back to the origins of Hasidism. It is a spiritual movement focused on awareness of the presence of God in every aspect of life. If you have that, then you are a Hasid. If you are cultivating that, if you are attempting to grow that in your heart and in your spirit, then you are on the Hasidic path. If you're not doing that, then no matter how big your shtreimel or no matter how long your garment is, then you're really not on the Hasidic path.
And so in an educational context, when he saw especially young people defecting and uninspired by their education, he lays this out in very moving fashion in the opening chapters of his book, Chovat HaTalmidim, Student's Obligation. What kind of program did he have for revitalizing that spirit which seems to have gotten lost?
Well, he talks about foregrounding what had been previously, what had been in large measure, left to the background. Sometimes, even to this day, in our educational system, what seems most obvious to the teachers is what doesn't get said. And it's a very important principle to say, don't forget to say what is most important first. And so you could have Hasidic schools, I would say even now, but certainly 100 years ago in Poland, where, oh, of course they would say, we know that it's all about connection with God, spirituality, but the day-by-day grinding existence of the Hasidic cheder had very little spirituality. First of all, there was corporal punishment, which was not only in the Hasidic schools, it was in all the schools, it was in all the chadarim. That's just the way it was. It was a very... frankly, it was a brutal, difficult life, not only for Jews, but for non-Jews as well. Poverty was absolutely endemic. This is one of the things that it's hard to realize. Even if you see sometimes the old photographs, but the impact of it is very powerful. I heard people who said that when they came from Poland to Western Europe in the 1920s, there was a gentleman who said, They kissed the ground. So why? Because they looked around and no children were without shoes. This gentleman said that in Poland, maybe 20% of the kids did not have shoes in the winter time. So many people, many families literally didn't know every day where the next meal would come from. So the difficulties that they faced and the transitions that we have faced are really hard to conceptualize. Just if I may, this is not exactly Pierre Setzner's story, but it's something that I learned that I would like to share. As I was doing the background research, I spoke to there was a Bustin, a Rebbe in Boston, passed away, and some of you might have met him, and his Rebbetzin. So Rebbetzin Horowitz, as a young girl, she was a teenager, she was sent back from the States to Poland. Just as young people now go to Israel, some young people were sent back to Poland to study, to learn. So she was sent back to her Hasidic family, and her family was of lineage, so that is to say it was a dynastic family. So her aunt and her uncle were Hasidic Rebbeim in a particular town, and there was a soup kitchen. The people would come in all day and all evening for soup. There was a young mother, thank you. there was a young mother who had a little infant, little baby, and she was waiting patiently in line for her turn with a soup bowl. Just as she came up, and the Rebbetzin, the older Rebbetzin, the relative of my interlocutor, the Bustiner Rebbetzin, who was then a young girl, was ladling out the soup, and this young mother gave a hard pinch to the little baby that she was holding in her arms, and the baby screamed out and began to weep. And the Bustiner Rebbetzin, who was, again, then a young girl, didn't know what was going on. Why did she do this? Her aunt from Poland, who was taking care of the soup, was ladling out the soup, saw the puzzlement, and she turned to the mother and she said, "You don't have to do that. You don't have to make your baby cry to make sure that I'll give a full ladle of soup. Don't worry, I'll give your child as much soup as you want." Do you understand the level of poverty? It was absolutely grinding. So I certainly don't want to condemn the Chadorim that were so, so oppressive. The conditions were unimaginable to us. But it's in that context that the Pierre Setzner said, not only must we eliminate corporal punishment, but we must genuinely honor, respect, and appreciate each and every child for what the child is now, and even more important, for what the child may become. We must see each child as a jewel, as someone precious, and as a soul that needs to be developed. And rather than force feed or impose anything, we should enlist the child in their own spiritual growth. Furthermore, as I said a moment earlier, don't leave the best for last. That is to say, we have to begin the spiritual path with the young children. We have to teach them not only the Aleph Beis and everything by rote, but what is the goal? The goal is to become a person of spirit, a person of nobility, a person of stature, a person of deep interpersonal relationships, and a person who has a deep interpersonal connection with God. That's the goal. We must say that from the very beginning. This was the path of the Pierre Setzner.
Can you trace for me the transition now, how he gets to Warsaw, becomes the sort of de facto Rebbe of the ghetto, how that works?
Okay. Well, he was the Rebbe in Pierre Setzner. Pierre Setzner was really a suburb of Warsaw. And after World War I, many of the Hasidic Rebbeim moved to the large cities because that's where the communities were. It's very ironic. We know that in World War II, the large cities were mercilessly attacked and bombarded from the air. First the Nazis did it, and then the Allies did it. In World War I, that generally didn't happen. The larger cities were spared in some measure, some of the attacks. It was the countryside where, as you recall, whether on the Western Front and the Eastern Front, the armies would go through the countryside and would simply devastate the local population. So people moved from the smaller towns and what we call the shtetlach to the larger cities. So there was this enormous movement to the big cities. In that area, it was Warsaw. So the Rebbes follow suit because that's where the community is. Because he was a pedagogue, he really had the spirit of education. He founded a Hasidic yeshiva, and it quickly became the largest Hasidic yeshiva in Warsaw. It was called Das Moshe, after his father-in-law, and he implemented his theories in that school. So he was in Warsaw. When the Second World War begins, he's already there. He's certainly not the only Hasidic Rebbe, but it turns out that over the course of the 3 years of the ghetto, actually, to be quite technical, I think in the first year it wasn't the Warsaw ghetto. The ghetto was really only fully established a bit later, but you could call it was occupied Warsaw. The Nazis were certainly there. And then the ghetto was really established, and things kept getting worse and worse. Throughout the period of those 3 years, as things were really spiraling down, everyone hoped every day that things would get better. Things constantly got only worse. There was, as has been said, there was a metaphysic of encirclement. That is to say, it was almost a paranormal encirclement. The circle kept getting tighter and tighter and closer and closer and more squeezed. During that horrible, long, grinding process, he gave drashot, what we would call sermons, but they were very learned, tightly woven, carefully constructed rabbinic theological sermons to his community. It was a dwindling community. Probably every week there were fewer people who came to shul than the week before. He lost almost all members of his family, many of whom were killed in the initial bombardment of Warsaw. Some of you may know that it was during Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, 1939. The Nazis specifically targeted the Jewish areas of Warsaw, and his son, his daughter-in-law, other members of the family, he lost maybe five or six members of the family within a week or two, horrible circumstances. And the Hasidim expected him, understandably, to be totally broken. And he was totally broken. It's not as if he didn't feel the pain, but he marshaled, from my point of view, superhuman resources, and he began giving sermons, or he continued his sermons, every single week. Saturday night, like right now, he would write down what he had said on Shabbat, and it gradually became a larger and larger pile of manuscripts. In the winter of 42 going into 43, when he really saw that he was not going to survive, there was just about nothing left. It was after what was called the great, really the horrible deportation of the summer of 1942, he realized that he would have to do something with the manuscripts. Ringelblum was collecting in an archive that he called Oneg Shabbos, and the rabbi put his manuscripts into a milk can. I don't know if it was formally part of the Oneg Shabbat collection, but it was nearby, and it was dug up after the war, and it was brought to the Jewish Historical Institute of Warsaw. He had a nephew in Tel Aviv who knew something about this. Somebody was sent to Warsaw after the war. They eventually found the manuscript, and it was published as the book that we know, the book that I have in my hand called Eish Kodesh.
Let's just go back a step. Who finds it under the ground?
It was a Polish worker. It was a non-Jewish worker. By the end of the war, Warsaw was essentially flat. That is to say, there were no buildings left on Warsaw. Even after the Jewish revolt, the one that we focus on, there was a Polish revolt a year later, and essentially they leveled the central part of Warsaw. So Warsaw had to be completely rebuilt, and in the post-war period, that's what they set to do. So they were laying the foundation of a new building. The worker found this cache of Hebrew manuscripts. He couldn't read it, but he did, we are so grateful, bring it to the Jewish Historical Institute. And it stayed there for quite a while until people from Israel started realizing that there would be texts and materials. They sent people to Warsaw, and they eventually found it.
Okay, so we'll get back to the history of the actual document in a bit. Let's talk about the theology at the heart of the book. When you read Esh Kodesh, there's, I guess, the most significant thing that strikes you is that there seems to be a profound kind of shift that takes place in his theology, and you've discussed this extensively and quite subtly in your work. What do I mean? So if you look at the Drashot at the beginning of the war, or when he starts writing, let's say March 1940, he's still explaining the troubles that are befalling them as, in one sense, he says, their punishment for being enthralled by secular culture. And in a sermon of August of 1941, he castigates those people who are exploiting the calamities as an excuse to evade the life of Torah. He writes, there are some people who are relying too much on the troubles and are constantly idle and talk stuff and nonsense the whole day. Is it impossible for them to use these hours in any event to study things that are not philosophical in nature or to recite Tehillim? So there's an edge to that, right? You know, you're kind of hiding behind all this suffering and not doing your due diligence as a Jew. Even a few months later in the Hanukkah sermon in 1941, he maintains that all the questions he's being asked, which are obviously very numerous by the Hasidim, are ignoring history, right? He says, what place is there for argumentation and for questions? Because those who say that the Jews have never undergone torments such as those of the present, they're mistaken. There were such in the destruction of the temple and Beitar. In other words, the Shoah is just more of the same. But it seems to me that later sermons kind of move. There's a different tone. And he says, only the troubles that befell us, and this is a footnote that he writes, I guess, by hand at the bottom of the sermon, and this was very striking to me. He says, only the troubles that befell us until the latter part of 5702 existed in the past. But in my view, unnatural troubles and bad and unnatural deaths, such as the perverse and evil murderers inflicted on the house of Israel from the end of that point, are unexampled in the writings of the sages and in the chronicles of Israel. May God have mercy and save us from their hands. In other words, this is unique. This has never happened before to any Jew anywhere. So that's really a change. I want to ask you, do you believe that he's changing his mind regarding the meaning of the suffering that he and his fellow Jews are undergoing? In other words, he's no longer able to easily offer these kind of religious formulas. And is he just expressing emotion, or is there actually theological questioning going on now of God?
So thank you for the question. Did you want to say more?
No.
Yeah. So this is, as you indicated, a subtle and crucial point. It is my belief, or it is my best sense, that the rabbi does not undergo a change in theology. I believe that he accurately and perceptively distinguishes and notes a change in the actual circumstance. I think it's helpful, again, I want to go a little bit into the background. We tend to think that the troubles begin, I don't know, in 1939. And again, in reading the history of that time and the decades before, one has to realize how difficult things were before what came to be called the Holocaust. I mean, of course, he never would have even known of the word Holocaust. Everything is developing and everything is unfolding. World War I, let's just begin with that, was a devastating time. There were hundreds of thousands of Jews in the service, in other words, in military service on both sides. But leaving that aside, hundreds of thousands of civilian Jews were killed in World War I. Every time the Russian troops advanced and the Germans or the Austrians retreated, and then the Germans came in and then the Russians retreated, every time thousands of Jews died. Something like close to 500,000 or 600,000 civilian Jews died in World War I. That was probably bigger than all the other massacres that we know of. It's orders of magnitude bigger than the medieval massacres that we still mourn to this day. In the keynote on Tisha B'Av, Speyer and Magenta, a few hundred people, and even the later massacres of the Middle Ages, not to diminish, of course, even any one single life, but this was extraordinary at the time. After World War I, the war didn't end when it ended, because there was a war between Poland and Russia. There was the war of the Reds and the Whites and the Soviet Union. It just went on and on and on, and Jews were dying. Jews were always in the crossfire. There was the Petlura massacres and so on. So what he's saying here in 1939-1940 is that it's correct that we have experienced troubles like this before. And if we had the spiritual resources to somehow have resilience and spiritual commitment and depth to rise above it, then we could do that now. That's what he's saying. And remember also that he's a pastor. That is to say, he's a mani kihila. I'm using an English term. He's a pastor of a community. He has to say something to give hope and courage and possibility and dignity to the community. He's looking at people who are literally starving. Their families are starving. The children are crying for milk. And he has to say something every single week. I mean, he didn't have to, but he felt the calling to rise up, to get up in shul, and to say something meaningful. Imagine what that meant to get up and to look people in the eye and to say something. The courage just to be able to do that. So he talks about earlier events. And he was certainly right that by 1939-1940, not in any way, he's certainly not diminishing what's happening. Everybody knew that he had lost his own family. So he's not giving them easy consolations, but he's putting it in some historical perspective. Then, and no one knew of something called Holocaust. No one knew of this so-called final solution. By the winter of 42-43, things had really changed. There were rumors that turned out to be tragically correct of extermination camps. That was something that was absolutely unprecedented. You know, Stephen Katz talks about the unique intentionality of the Holocaust. What it means is that this idea that, Rahmanul Itzlan, every single last Jew in the world. I once heard a historian say, I haven't verified it myself, but I heard a very serious historian say that if God forbid, the Nazis had won the war in Europe, the first thing they would have said to the Americans was, give us every American Jew. That would have been part of the peace terms. That's part of the unique intentionality. Unfortunately, we've had many, many pogroms, many, many massacres, Khmelnytsky, and so on. And I'm saying the forgotten massacres of World War I Maybe 600,000 Jews. It was that was unparalleled before World War I. And we don't, I'd like to see a conference on that period. What he's writing is historically accurate when he sees that what he's living through is going beyond even that, and that the intentionality and the cruelty, the sadism, the sadistic glee at tormenting before killing. It's like, you know, they believed Jews were vermin. Did they have to torture the vermin before killing the vermin? So this is unprecedented. So he's acknowledging this. So I don't see theological change. I see frank and honest and fearless awareness that what he said before is no longer accurate now, because the history, what he's living through, is unprecedented.
So you're saying he's reacting to circumstances.
He's reacting accurately to the shift in circumstance.
Do we know from the sermons whether the utility of what he's doing is working? In other words, you've made a strong case here for the fact that he feels a moral and religious responsibility as the leader of the community to get up every week and try and inspire them. Do we know whether it's working? Do we know whether he's becoming aware, somewhat abysmally, of the inability to do this?
First of all, he's not only inspiring the community, and I'm sure it was diminishing every week. There were people who died of starvation, there were people who died of typhus. It was extraordinarily dispiriting. But he's also arguing with God. That's another side of it. That his boldness in his piety, you see, there's a kind of question that comes from maybe lack of piety, lack of faith. This is to say, the very legitimate and very commonly heard question, well, I can't believe in God because how could God do X? How could God do X? And I'm not even talking about 1939 to 1945. There's so many other X's that you could fill in the blank with. How could God do X? I can't believe in God. But there's an arguing with God that comes from faith. And his arguing with God came from faith. He says, God, I hold you to the terms of the covenant. One of the first teachings in this book is an extraordinary, it's Shabbos Shuvah Tafshin. That is to say, 1939, the Shabbat between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, the Shabbat Shuvah, meaning the Shabbat of repentance. And so he quotes the Gemara. There's a beautiful midrash, a Talmudic Agadah, that says, God keeps all the mitzvot. God keeps all the commandments. And some of you may know, there's a passage in Brachot where it says, God puts on tefillin. For example, God prays. And he also draws on these Talmudic passages that trouble the Jewish philosophers, but that were seized upon as profound and meaningful by the Kabbalists. But anyway, he develops this further on his own, creatively, and he says, well, if God does all the mitzvot, what about repentance? And he demands that God repent. This is in September 1939, as if he's saying, God, I see the darkness unfolding. Stop now. But this argument is out of faith. You understand? It's not out of weakness of faith. It's not out of doubt. It's not out of moving into secularity or into atheism or agnosticism. It's out of the fervor and the intensity of his belief that he feels he can hold God to the terms of the covenant. So he argues with God. He tries to inspire the people as much as he can. How effective? It's difficult to say. But I would say that beyond the words, see, that when you see a courageous person who has been devastated by life, devastated by an unprecedented situation. This was already in September 39. Again, most of his personal tragedy, at least in terms of his immediate family, his community kept dying day after day, week after week. But the personal family, it was gone by the end of September 1939. One daughter was still with him. But his wife had died, his mother died, his son died, his daughter-in-law died, a sister who was there, sister-in-law was there, was died. Within a few weeks, he was saying Kaddish for five people at a time. So, and when the community sees such a person rising to the bima and speaking words of holiness, words of blessing, words of hope, words that speak of the dignity of Israel, meaning the dignity of the Jew, he says it again and again. They try to demean us. Before they kill us, they try to drag us into the lowest murkiness. Don't ever forget that every Jew is a member of nobility. He quotes the Beis Aharon, one of his Hasidic ancestors. De Gresta Zach von Ayid is nist zu vergessen as men is a ben melech. Every Jew is a member of aristocracy. Every Jew is a noble person. Every Jew is born to the peerage. And he says this again and again, while they're starving and while they're being massacred already, even in 1939, 1940. So how effective, I don't know. But beyond the message is the inner strength, is the inner power, is the inner vision to envision something beyond the present reality. To say, as devastating as it is, we are not only beholden to the present reality. We have a noble past, and I guarantee you, he says, we as a people have an equally noble and inspiring future, and that is what we need to hold in our eyesight.
So what I'm hearing from you is that there doesn't seem to be a kind of cognitive dissonance, right? Because on the one hand, he's responding to history. He's seeing it happen. It's getting worse and worse, and it's being reflected in the sermons. On the other hand, you're saying that the faith remains steady and the questions are coming from a sort of lack of understanding as opposed to a defection from faith. And there's nothing in there that, so in other words, there's no historical circumstance that's going to make him move off of that stance.
I would say that empirically, as far as I know, he retained his core commitments and frankly his spiritual dignity until the very end. One of the privileges that I had when I was doing this research, and this goes back to the late 70s and the early 80s, mostly in Israel. Actually, there was a gentleman in Toronto. I won't mention his name, but I had a wonderful interview with a gentleman in Toronto who was a survivor. In any event, mostly in Israel, people who survived. And one of them had contacted him in the labor camp where he was sent at the very, very end. This was actually after the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. And he was one of the few survivors. He was there with leadership of the Jewish community, whoever had survived. And the story was that he had made what's called, what we call in Hebrew, a tekiyas kaf. A tekiyas kaf, that is to say, they made a compact. And he was the only Hasidic rabbinic figure, probably the only what we would call today Orthodox Jew. The others were secular. There was a historian. There were medical doctors. There were lawyers. There were communal leaders, social workers, and so on. And they said, you know, we are maybe the only survivors of Warsaw Jewry. This is in 1943 already, and we will stay together. And if somebody tries to escape, we won't do it unless we can all go. Well, I met a gentleman by the name of Simcha Ratheiser Rotem, who I was told, and I verified this, contacted made it to this labor camp. The labor camp is called Travniki. Not Treblinka, Travniki, different place. It was not a death camp, at least at that point. And he was sent, and he said we could take one or two people out, bribe the guards and get some people out. There were safe houses. The P.S. Setzner Rebbe, he said, he saw the P.S. Setzner Rebbe. P.S. Setzner Rebbe said, I will not escape without everybody. I'm not going to leave without all the others. It indicates to me, to me that's a verified story. Rutheiser's memoir was published by Yale. There's an English version that was published by Yale University Press. Not only did he retain his faith, he retained his, I think, equally important to faith, at least for me, is his sobriety, his stability, his balance, his inner coherence, his sense of nobility, his sense of wisdom. He retained his stature as a Hasidic, dynamic, spiritual person of wisdom and of grace until the very end, despite everything that had happened. So it's not just that he, as we say, believed in God, but he continued to believe in the deepest way in the possibilities of the human condition and in humanity, and that ability to retain core commitments. It goes beyond statements like, oh, I believe in God. Yes, you believed in God, of course, it's true. But to retain that sense of balance, not to be blindsided, not to be utterly set awry, set somehow to be flung by some centripetal force that flings away the center, as we know so many people that it happened to them, and we understand it. We're not judging those people. But here was somebody who had experienced the worst that could be experienced and retained the centeredness and the focus and the mindfulness and the attachment to God and to other human beings. This is the inspirational example.
So that's interesting to me. I'm thinking now as you're talking about the conceptions of human nature and the human condition in other people who write about the Shoah. I'm thinking about, you know, Primo Levi, Paul Celan, Jean Améry, and so on. And one of the things you note is not necessarily the sort of optimism about the human condition. It varies from writer to writer, depending on what their experience was and how they thought beforehand. But you're saying that he maintains an optimism about humanity itself in spite of that experience.
Because he maintains his core commitments, which include the fact, Genesis chapter 1, God saw the world that God had made, and it was good. And the end, it says, and it was very good. And he retains that belief. He retains the belief, first of all, in the dignity of the Jewish people, in the face of everyone saying, this was a given even before the war. The almost the worst insult would be to say, Jude, you know, Jude is this, you know. For him, of course, as for many German Jewish leaders, Martin Buber, others as well, but certainly for a Hasidic master, the Jew meant we are the people with this enormously rich heritage. We have the dignity, we retain it no matter what others are saying or doing, and we have this core commitment to human nobility, to faith, to hope, to the possibility of going beyond the horizon that we see now. I mean, this is the core of all religion, the core of Judaism, and certainly of all of Hasidism, which is not to be overly swayed by the immediacy of the experience of the now. He always talks about his ancestors. His father, the Grudzinsker Rebbe, was a great Hasidic master, grandfather, all the way going back five, six generations to the Maggid of Kozhenitz. And he also saw somehow, he didn't know how or when or where or in what way, but he knew, he felt the Jewish people would survive, would flourish, good would return to the world. There's something even more astonishing. Without ever mentioning the word German or Nazi, he found a way, and this is one of the most striking things in the book. He found a way to say, we must not demonize even the people who are so horribly oppressing us in an essentialist way. He doesn't say Germans or Nazis, but he quotes certain midrashim, puzzling midrashim. There's one ancient tradition, actually this comes from a Kabbalistic source, that in the Kabbalah, in the Zohar, the devil, Satan, it takes on a real personality. Satan is described in very, very personal terms. And there's a Kabbalistic tradition that in the Messianic era, there's a mem in the name of Satan, and the mem stands for Mavet, or death. In the Messianic era, the mem will be taken out, and what's left is the name of a most sacred angel. Meaning that the devil himself must be redeemed. Then he finds another midrash which encodes, again, this is in the language of the Kabbalah and the midrash, he won't say it explicitly, that there is no direct reference to the persecutors by name. Again, it doesn't say the word Nazi, it doesn't say SS, it doesn't say German. The word German does not appear in this book. But in an encoded way, he finds a midrash that says as follows. You all remember the Garden of Eden story. And the bad actor in the Garden of Eden story is, of course, the serpent, right? The Nachash. Well, there's a midrash that says that one day the Nachash is going to become our best friend and is going to travel the world and will bring us delicacies and fine jewels. Now, who knows what that midrash means? It's an ancient midrash. But he applies it in this circumstance, meaning that even as we fervently pray that this horrible persecution stop, and of course in an immediate way, he experiences it as terrible and horrible. He's not in any way, God forbid, justifying or this is not an exculpatory idea. But he's saying we cannot create a domain, as I said this morning, we cannot create a domain of there is absolute good and then there's absolute evil. There are people who are irredeemably evil. He explicitly negates that idea. Because if you do that, that means that there's a domain where God is not to be found. If God is not to be found anywhere, then where can God be found anywhere at all? We say, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one," which Hasidism interprets to mean God has to be everywhere without exception. Therefore, you cannot essentialize this darkness. And he says, we believe that not only will the Jewish people survive somehow in a way that we don't understand with our dignity intact, but that even the oppressor will turn and there will be a redemptive moment. So he doesn't give up faith in anyone, and he certainly doesn't give up faith in God.
I got to sit with that for a minute. He seems to bring God in as a kind of partner in all of this suffering, and seems to resuscitate this notion that God is crying, is weeping, as all of this goes along. Maybe you can sketch out a little for us this theology of divine weeping.
Sure. In the Jewish philosophical tradition, as most powerfully and nobly expressed by Moses Maimonides, but there were many others, the medieval Jewish philosophers were deeply influenced by the Greek philosophical tradition, especially by Aristotle, as mediated through the Islamic, the great Muslim philosophers who translated the Greek into Arabic and in that period were really the bearers of great culture. And Maimonides, of course, grew up in an Arabic Islamic culture, and so in some ways that was his language. He wrote in Arabic much as we write in English. So that philosophical tradition says God is the unmoved mover. And in The Guide of the Perplexed, this Maimonides' greatest philosophical work, he speaks in that way, that we relate to God as the absolute, as what he calls the active intellect, and as we refine ourselves and move ever higher in our mind and in our removing the baggage of the physical, we can attain communion with or conjunction with what again is called the active intellect. You might say this philosophical God. In the Kabbalah, by contrast, especially in the Zohar, God is not the unmoved mover, to take a formulation that I'm borrowing from Abraham Joshua Heschel. He says, God is the most moved mover. In the Zohar, in the Kabbalah, see, in medieval philosophy, the nobility of God is being unchangeable. And there's a verse. There's a verse in Malachi, Ani Hashem lo shaniti, I, God, I never change. Well, that is one verse, but there's a lot of other things going on as well. And as the Zohar and the Kabbalists and the Hasidism say, and again, the late Abraham Joshua Heschel wrote a whole book on this theme called The Prophets. It's already very much in The Prophets. The prophets of Israel channel God as being so devoted to the relationship with Israel, and therefore so disappointed when the Jewish people, when Israel in the biblical period doesn't live up to the conditions of the covenant, that God is zealous and jealous and angry. God is passionately involved, and therefore God suffers when we suffer. This is different than the philosophical tradition. God suffers with us. God suffers on behalf of us. God is fully participatory in the human suffering, in the human condition. This is boldly anthropomorphic, but this is what you find in the Bible and certainly in the rabbinic literature, and it's called, Heschel calls it, divine pathos. So that's the background for this, and there are many passages in the Talmud that tend to focus on the destruction of the temple and speak about God weeping, God's tears. There's one passage that says that God's tears flow from the divine eyes. Now, I would never say such a thing, but there it is in the Midrash and the Talmud. And it says that an angel of mercy has to swoop down and catch the divine tear before it lands on earth. Because if the divine tear would land on earth, the earth would explode. And so in order to save the earth, the angel of mercy sort of catches the divine tear in mid-trajectory. And he quotes all these passages. So he's not making this up. He's drawing on an aspect of the tradition, I would say, that stood in the background, because many of us, when we learn Judaism and when we teach Judaism, teach the Maimonidean version. It's very austere, it's very noble, it's very profound, it's highly conceptual, it's cerebral, it makes sense. This is, frankly, mythic. How do we understand God's tears, God's eyes, the angel swoop? What does this mean? I don't know, but Midrash says what it says, and the Zohar picks up on it, and he draws on exactly these anthropomorphic and anthropopathic, meaning God's pain. And he says something astounding. He says, we believe God is infinite. If we believe God is infinite, that has the following troubling implication. When God feels pain, then God feels infinite pain. And that's something beyond which any human being can possibly comprehend. And he says, we have to participate and feel compassion for God's pain at this time. As much as we're asking God to feel our pain, we have to feel the divine pain.
Do you think this was a comforting sort of trope for him, that the idea that God would feel suffering? Did he actually experience that as somehow solace?
I do think so. I think that. See, at the end of the day, look, he certainly wanted to be saved. He certainly wanted his community to be saved. He wanted salvation to come in a very physical way. Now, again, he never talks about. You never see plotting and planning about, will the British participate in this battle, or will the Russians finally attack from the Eastern Front? There is no political or military strategizing whatsoever. But he desperately wanted the people to be saved in a physical sense, in a material sense, in an actual sense. But he saw that that wasn't happening. And he says, at the end of the day, what is left? What is really left? The only thing that is left is relationship. And in many ways, you hear this from people who survived and witnesses who saw people who didn't survive. I'm thinking of one memoir I read, this heart-wrenching memoir of a father with five small children, who walked together to the place where what was about to happen. And the only thing that the father has to give to his children is his hands. That's all he gave. And it was meaningful that he gave it. That was the relationship, the love. That was the last thing that the father and the children experienced, was that love. God was so real to Rabbi Shapiro that whether he was saved or not in a physical sense, he had the relationship with God, and he wanted his Hasidim to feel that as well.
Let's move forward a little bit to the sort of post-war reception. Something amazing happened with the Eish Kodesh, which is that from a situation of, the metaphor of being buried, where the work is buried and you don't know who this person is, to the current situation, where he's a very significant figure on the spiritual scene. I know where I live in Israel, in yeshivot that are not Hasidic, that are Dati Lumi, people are studying the Eish Kodesh. So the interest seems to be booming, and not just in Hasidic circles. His books are read and studied. Why do you think there's been this renewed interest now, especially in non-Hasidic circles? Like, what kind of message or inspiration do you think people are culling here?
So the first thing I have to say is that while I and many people encounter Rabbi Shapiro through this extraordinary document, what he wrote from 1939 to the summer or later, a little bit later of 1942, essentially three years. That's how we first encounter this rabbi, because of the spiritual heroism, the courage, the dignity, what I'm calling the inner stability, the inner centeredness. That's very powerful, but that wouldn't be enough to explain this phenomenon. Once you discover him, you have to realize that he spent his whole life cultivating that noble inner self. And he gives you, in another series of books, he has a series on Hasidic educational philosophy, which is just about unique. You know, we are going to be cautious about saying the word unique. but essentially either exceedingly rare or almost unique in the Hasidic world, where he takes you through the pedagogy of what does it mean to develop a noble inner spirit. And as you mentioned a few moments ago, he begins with Chovat HaTalmidim for very young students, and then there's a graded sequence, there's a developmental sequence. It's almost as if, well, it's like a Piaget model, except that instead of cognitive development or intellectual development or learning about math and what concepts in math you have to be, you know, but it's a graded sequence. Now it's about the spirit. He says, you can develop your own inner spirit to become this person of balance and centeredness and nobility and altruism and vision and coherence and noble aspiration that looks beyond the self-centeredness. And he shows you how to do it. He takes you step by step. And this is the legacy that largely people are discovering. He has a meditation technique. Many of us in the States, I assume it's not so dissimilar in Canada, go to places in the Eastern world for cultivating meditative techniques. He taught a meditation technique in Warsaw in the 20s and 1930s, and he calls it the hashkata, the stilling of the mind, the silencing of the mind, the quieting of the mind. And he takes you through how one quiets one's mind and then instills a certain thought and looks to spiritual aspiration, ending with a beautiful nigun, and it's a structured technique of inner development. And he has many, many other things like this as well. He has psychological acumen, spiritual depth, inner integrity, vision, ability to write with clarity and conviction, and to bring people into his circle of understanding. This is very persuasive and very attractive. And so despite the fact that his children were killed, and this alone is so devastating, he had a lovely young son who he put so much hope in, a fine young man, a scholar, and would have been a worthy successor, and that was the son that was killed in the initial bombing of Warsaw. After going through 5 days of agony, he was hit by shrapnel, and he went through 5 days of agony before he died. So that son died. So he and then the daughter died, the son-in-law, the entire immediate family died. There was an uncle, a nephew in Tel Aviv. A brother, a nephew in Tel Aviv. That's how we have. Thankfully, that's how we have the written writings, the published writings. But rather than having this sort of court with a dynasty, what remains are these profound, noble, lofty, poetic, moving instructions on the spiritual life in a very concrete and specific way. This is transformative.
It strikes me as you're talking that would be the connection. I know that there's a Kalbachian connection, and I could see where that would come from. There's a famous story that Kalbachians tell, Rav Shlomo Carlebach in his concerts used to tell the following story, that he had an encounter with a Tel Aviv street cleaner who turned out to be one of the students of the Eish Kodesh. And Rabbi Carlebach insisted that the man teach him something from the Rebbe. Say, tell me some of the Rebbe's Torah. And took some persuasion, and finally the street cleaner tells him the following. He says, here's a teaching from the Rebbe. The greatest thing in the world is to do good for someone, to do someone else a favor. It's the greatest thing you can do is to do good from someone else.
So if I could...
Different versions in different concerts. I've heard I heard different tapes, and he says different things. So I'm wondering, that seemed to have... He said it so often that it seemed to have had some impact for him.
So, with your permission, if I may, the way I heard the story from him. Actually, I actually asked him for the story.
Good.
And I'm going to try to remember the version that he told.
Good.
That he told us, meaning my wife and I. He says as follows. He's in Tel Aviv. They say Carlebach is in Tel Aviv. and it's after a concert, and he's walking along Rehov HaYarkon, and this is a street that abuts some of the large hotels, and behind the large hotels, they have beachfront. There is the beach, the Mediterranean. And it's late at night, not too many people out and about, and he sees somebody who is actually a worker for the hotel, cleaning the outer area outside the hotels, sweeping. And the man is, in his words, a hunchback. His bodily is cruelly misshapen. And so, if you know Shlomo Carbach, he would always greet everybody. So he says, you know, shalom, shalom, shalom alech. And the man answered in the Polish accent, aleichem shalom. He says, ah, you're from Poland. Where are you from? So the man said, Piasecznia. And Shlomo Carbach said, well, I've been reading the books of the Piasecznia. I've never met somebody who knew him in person. Did you know him? He said, did I know him? I was one of the boys who would eat at his house Friday night. Because again, you know, even if you had a family, people often had no money whatsoever. He had a large number of students who would come to the house Friday night. The Rebbetzin was a mother to all the students. And they would serve the Friday night dinner. They would sing beautiful Kozhenitz melodies. And then they would serve the meal that might be the only square meal the kids had all week long. And there was the fish, and there was the chicken and the cholent and so on, all the different courses. And Shlomo said, well, could you tell me one of the teachings? He says, well, to be honest with you, I don't remember the more involved teachings because you see what I look like. I was a strong young boy, and I was taken for labor, and they beat me, and my body never grew back properly. This is to say, here was somebody who really needed orthopedic work, serious orthopedic surgery, and he never got it. So his body was misshapen, and he survived the war. He comes to Israel. The only thing he can do is kind of menial labor, not a very happy life. So Shlomo says, but tell me something. So he says, well, this I remember. When we were with the other kids and sitting at the table with the Rebbe and the Rebbetzin, and it was Malchus, it was royalty. We were treated once a week as princelings, as royalty. And between each one of the courses, there would of course be nigunim, there would be Hasidic melodies. But the Rebbe would say this phrase again and again, Kinderlach gedenk, de grester Sach in de Welt, is tien imitzin atoive. Children, remember, the greatest thing in the world is to do someone a favor. And he would say this again and again. Then they came and they killed my family. But again, because I was young and strong, I survived, and I was in the camp. And the following happened. One night, I can't go to sleep. And I realize that I have nothing in the world to live for. My family has all been killed. I have no immediate relatives. I have no real friends. And there was an electric fence, and I am tempted to walk to the fence and just end my life. And as I get up out of the barracks and start walking to the fence, I hear a voice. Now he tells Carbach, you know, I'm not saying it was a supernatural voice. I know psychology. It could have been my own imagining. It doesn't matter. Rabbi, I heard a voice. And the voice said, Kinderlach gedenk, der größte Sach in der Welt, ist tien imitzen a teuva. children remember the greatest thing in the world is to do someone a favor. And I was startled. And I realized, I said, was that really, or did it come from me? I don't know. But then I remembered the Friday night and the dinner and the way the rabbis Rebbetzin treated us with such warmth and respect and the other children. And I looked around and I said, can I do anything to help anybody here? And I go back to the barracks and somebody is moaning and weeping. And I said, tell me your story. And they said, you don't want to hear it. You've heard it a million times. I said, no, tell me your story. And that person told me their story. And I gave them as much comfort as I could. And then I went to the next person. And that's how I got through the night. And there were other times through those years that I was tempted. And each time I recalled or I heard, I remembered the rabbi's voice, and I was brought back to life. And then I was in a DP camp, and there was youth aliyah, and somehow I came to Israel, and you see that I was not prepared for any real work. And Rabbi, I would love to marry, I would love to have a family. It's not possible. It's not possible. And even here, I don't have close relatives. Rabbi, do you hear the ocean behind the hotel? And he could hear the waves. You could hear the waves of the Mediterranean. And he said, Rabbi, I'm embarrassed to tell you, but sometimes I'm tempted to walk into the ocean and not to come back. And each and every time I hear my Rebbe's voice. And then he turns to Rabbi Karlbach and he says, do you know how many favors you can do for people on the streets of Tel Aviv? That's the story.
I'm done. I think we have a few minutes for questions from the floor, if people are interested in asking a question. So can I just have a show of hands if there's anybody who wants to ask a question? Okay. So we're going to make it brief. Lisa's going to carry the mic around. Before we do that, I'd like you to all give Rabbi Polin a warm hand. Anybody up? Let's make the question brief, please.
My question is...
Please say your name.
My name is Alan Rowland. My question is, you mentioned that Rebbe was well-known in the ghetto. Did he work with other synagogues? Like, my family used to govern at the great synagogue in the ghetto. So I was just wondering if you had your connection with the neighborhood with the rabbi.
Yeah, so I don't know specifically about the great synagogue. I will say this. While he was certainly a noted Hasidic Rebbe, he was not central to the political life. He deliberately avoided political affiliations. There was a very large prominent, actually large and prominent even to this day, Hasidic group in Warsaw, the Ger Hasidim. The Ger Hasidim were the largest and most powerful and politically influential Hasidic group in Warsaw. The Ger Rebbe was a powerfully influential leader. Agudas Yisrael, which is really a political movement as well as a religious spiritual movement, he was at the head of it. This particular Rebbe, the one that I'm talking about, very much stayed in the background as a matter of policy. He told his Hasidim not to get involved in politics, even what for him would be good politics. That is to say, politics that he would have believed in, like promotion of Sabbath observance. Like, he wanted stores to be closed on the Sabbath, of course. But he said, don't get involved in political movements that put pressure on other people, because inevitably it drags you into competitiveness, to argumentation, and to all the, shall we say, the difficult, murky aspects of political life everywhere, whether it's in Warsaw in the 1930s, whether it's Canada or the U.S. We are no stranger to, shall we say, less than crystalline, clear political life. So he knew what he was talking about. And so even when you have very good goals that you firmly believe in, he was not part of the Hasidic political world. So I don't have a specific answer to that question, but that's just in terms of the background.
Dov Harris is my name.
I'm sorry, Don Harris?
Dov.
Yes. Yes.
When the rabbi argued with God, did he actually believe that God could be persuaded by his argument? Or was he just going through the motions so much, but you're exposing himself? But was there that understanding that just maybe God could be deceived?
God went to see. I do believe that. That is to say, this goes back to the Bible. That is to say, Moses is, of course, the great example of this, Moshe. And many times he intercedes, you know, after the golden calf. You can't imagine a sin worse than the golden calf. They get the Ten Commandments. The main, the headline of the Ten Commandments is, don't make idols. That's pretty clear. Like, what part of that didn't they not understand? And yet, they make an idol. So, they're gone. And Moses goes up the mountain, he intercedes, and he says, don't think, God, that you will destroy the people and make me, because then I'm out of here. And God backs down. So you have all this precedent. He totally believed in it. This is what a Hasidic master does. We may not, I'm not here to promote or promulgate any theology whatsoever, but I have to be accurate to what I know about the Hasidic movement in general, and this rabbi in particular. They believe in divine intercession. They believe that one can tap into the compassionate aspect of divinity even when things seem possibly hopeless. It doesn't mean that it's necessarily going to happen. You may ask a question, the answer may be no, and that has to be accepted. But sometimes the answer will be yes. And so he does believe that he can argue with God. Yes.
We have time for one more, but it doesn't look like we have one more. So I'm going to ask Rabbi Kelman to come up and close the evening.
Going to be bad after these emotional talks. Just I want to thank you, really, to say, you know, I had the I don't want to say, you know, pleasure, but I had the experience of being in Poland for the first time in the summer. We had a very moving trip, and
Thank you very much.